Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. This hour on the program, we'll learn more about the lives of African-American men here in the United States. We'll hear word portraits of a government official, an entrepreneur, a blue-collar worker, a young man searching for a job, a federal investigator, and a hardened criminal. It's a real cross-section of lives as documented in a Washington Post series, a year-long series that ran in 2006, featuring in-depth portraits of black men, mostly in the D.C. area. We'll hear their stories, and also we'll learn the results of a Washington Post poll of African-American men, which found that a majority of black men say it's a good time to be a black man in America, and they're optimistic about their own future. But the poll also found that African-American men are in many ways deeply divided over the way they see themselves in their country. We'll find out more from the poll and more about some of the men profiled with my guest, Kevin Merida, one of the editors of the Washington Post series, one of the writers as well. The Post articles are collected in a new book entitled Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. From the Washington Post this morning, welcome Kevin Merida. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Fred. It's nice to be here.
And after we lay a little groundwork here, 614-292-8513 for your comments and questions. Kevin, quite a commitment of resources from the Post, the articles, video and audio material on the website. What was the process? Why did you and your colleagues decide to do this groundbreaking series?
Well, it actually goes back to 2000, I believe. A writer by the name of Robert Pierre, you know, had just suggested, just in conversation, it'd be great to do a series on black men. And that effort really didn't go very far. We started and had a few meetings, and then we couldn't quite all come together. Some people left. There was 9-1-1, and it kind of faded. In 2005, the 10th anniversary of the Million Man March, which was the largest gathering of black men in the history of this country, me and Daryl Fears, who is a national reporter, were having lunch at a corner deli, and he was preparing to write about the 10th anniversary of this march, which is really a kind of a seminal event. And we were just talking, you know, what had happened to black men in that 10-year period since the march. And the more we talked, the more we started, what about reviving the idea of doing a series? And we began to meet informally. And that group kind of grew, and it was really something that started from the ground up, so to speak. Just interested writers and editors began to just brainstorm about what a project should look like. I think that ultimately, you know, that project resulted in, as you said, a big commitment of resources from the Washington Post, and also with our online partner, WashingtonPost.com. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being 15 articles from June to December 31st, 2006, dozens of online chats, narrated photo galleries, video documentaries, oral histories. There was interactive quality to it because people wrote in and commented on it. We had some town hall meetings in the community to get people's feedback. So it became quite a community project. And now, as you pointed out to your listeners, it lives on as a book mm-hmm. with some new material.
Let's take a look at the poll here that the Washington Post took. 60% of black men say it's a good time to be a black man in America. Black men are optimistic about their own future. 79% optimistic, but they're divided on the future of the group. In other words, all black men. 34% of black men say the prospect for all black men is getting worse. 36% say staying about the same. They also concluded that for some of the problems of black men, that they themselves bear some responsibility. 59% said black men have failed to do some things that would have helped. But they also blame the system. 56% say the system is stacked against black men. So there's a variety of responses here. Huh?
Well, I think that the poll points out just the complexities that live within the lives of black men. And I think that was one of the driving reasons for doing the project. I think that, you know, all groups and segments of society would like to see their lives dealt with in with all of the nuance and complexities of those lives. You know, whether you're a farmer or a teenager, a corporate executive. We felt that black men had really been caricatured in some ways. You have the portrait, if you look at the nightly news in most major cities across the country, you see a disproportionate number of men as criminals in, mm-hmm. in the nightly news segments. On television, in the pop culture realm, you see a lot of men, black men, represented as kind of the often the hardened, menacing, and sometimes cool figures that are idolized in pop culture and the rap world. The athletes are certainly have visibility, and you have a few smattering of a smattering of outsized successes like the Barack Obamas and the Colin Powells, and then amid that group are all kinds of black men that are really virtually invisible. And I think that the poll captured how complex those lies are. They don't blame black men, don't blame everything on racism. They do recognize that discrimination is still a factor in American life. They wonder that, you know, there are things in the system that have held them down, but they also hold black men themselves accountable for some of the images that exist in this country. And there was a guy who was quoted in the polling story that you cited, Edward Howe. He was one of the first quotes. He said, "I get frustrated with my brothers, with black men wasting life. But then on the other hand, I wonder, is there something in society that keeps us down?" And so I think that there is a sense of kind of reflection that you see in the poll. And we tried to capture that kind of reflection throughout the series in a number of narrative stories that were essentially portraits of individual lives.
Let's talk about one of those. Antoine Ford, profiled by Washington Post reporter Keith Alexander. He runs a technology consulting firm called Enlightened Inc. and very successful in Washington. But at the same time, the contradictions here. On his website, if you look at the opening page, apparently stock photos of four young white people, even though this is mostly a black-run firm. But he felt necessary to put that on the front page, so he didn't want to scare people away. He said he wants what he called a chance to get into the room.
Well, I think that for this generation of African-American business, man, they have a different model that they're following. I mean, there was a time back in the Jim Crow period, the early black businesses, they were always doing business with black consumers. There were all kinds of businesses in black communities. My stepdad's father ran essentially a shoe repair business. Those businesses were a lot of struggles for African Americans. Often they had to pay more for their goods, but they did business in black communities. And nowadays, you know, African Americans are trying to branch out. Many are leaving corporate America to start out on their own. They're taking the skills that they received in the workplace and all of their degrees, and they're trying to go out and start on their own. Antoine Ford is in the high-tech consulting business, and that's an industry that there are not many African Americans running businesses like that. I think he felt, and his partners, who began this dream at George Washington University in D.C. when they were students, felt like they had to be inclusive, and that was a choice that they made. Others would not have made that choice to show that the face, at least on the internet, the public face of their business showed a lot of white faces. Some people disagree with that, and the story showed that there were black employees in the company who worried that, thought that, hey, you have your business now, you don't have to, you know, so represented with the face of the whites, but that was something they felt they had to do.
Yeah, but Antoine Ford, he said he was concerned that people wouldn't think, if they thought the firm was black-run, that they would not be perceived by white people in government. He does mostly government contracts, I guess.
Yes,
would not be perceived as competent. And he was told by one government purchaser of services that he needed to lighten up his sales force, namely don't send, you know, two or three black people, send some white people as well. You're going to get more business. I mean, that says an awful lot about the society, doesn't it?
It says an awful lot about the society, and it's the kind of thing that I thought that portrait was one of the rare, you know, kind of inside looks at the the startup of a small business, regardless of race.
Yeah.
But it was particularly significant. Keith Alexander did a great job of getting inside and that company and really kind of showing what it's like to be a beginning business. Antoine Ford and his group had had some success, but again, he was still worried. It was always kind of a fragile success. You think that you're not going to make it into the big realm, and you want to. And so you're going cautiously. You're feeling your way. You don't have a lot of models for
sure.
Achievement, at least from the black standpoint. And so they were very much guys just kind of feeling their way.
Kevin Merida joins us from the Washington Post this morning. Their year-long series on black men is now in a paperbound book released. It's called Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. We're at 614-292-8513. We'll go to your phone calls in just a moment. All kinds of contradictions. Eric Motley, right?
Yes.
A young man who's been very successful in the Bush administration, right? And
yes.
But he's a conservative. And he gets a little static when he goes back home to Alabama. Some of his mentors, he gets a little bit of static about being conservative, and one implied that he was thinking like a white person. So he's got some difficulties, even though he's been very successful.
Well, that's another interesting portrait. I'll just say for your listeners, Fred, written by Will Haygood,
yes.
one of the outstanding writers of the country, and Columbus's own.
That's right.
Will is from Columbus and a brilliant writer of biographies of Sammy Davis Jr. and others, Adam Clayton Plowell Jr. But Will was able to, I think, do something special in this piece, because I think that there's been a lot written about the black Republican is kind of an archetype. And we didn't want to do a piece that was just another piece that would discuss the politics of whether or not you choose to be a Democrat or a Republican, but really show one individual's journey into how he came to think the way he does. And in this case, he was raised in the cradle of the civil rights movement in Montgomery with people who had dined with King. But through this piece, Will was showing that how his education really shaped him. And the farther up he went in the education, the educational ladder, and studied abroad, and he began to have other influences. Somehow that led him, this personal influences led him toward joining the Republican ranks. I mean, he studied abroad. He had very eclectic taste, and he represents the kind of African American that, again, is often visible. He reads Tennyson, has a great collection of British literature in his home. He doesn't fit certain stereotypes about black men, and yet I think he sees himself as a black man, and I think that's another part of that.
He's a director of the State Department's Office of International Visitors, supervises a staff of more than 100, oversees a budget that exceeds $80 million. When he went back home, one of the elders in his community who mentored him said to Eric Motley, he says, "You know Bob Carter, the judge?" He says to Eric, and Eric nods, I guess, and he says, "Well, he once wrote an article about a black judge, about a man in a black robe who thinks white." And then, as Will Haygood writes, there's a momentary silence, and then Eric Motley blurts out, "Well, my name certainly wasn't in that article." And he lets loose with some nervous laughter, and the elder doesn't crack a smile. So there's a hard road to hoe a little bit for a black man who's, from earliest youth, decided he was going to be a conservative.
I think that there's disappointment. There's always disappointment when I think that some of the people in this story had helped nurture him, and they had wrapped their arms around him. They had helped teach him, and there's disappointment in the way he turned out. And you see that often with some of the most successful African Americans. I recently had written a book with Mike Fletcher of the Post colic about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. And there was the same kind of evidence in his biography that there were people who were just disappointed in the way he turned out, because there's often an expectation that those who succeed at the highest rungs, as African-Americans, that they should be a certain way, that they should represent the race in a certain way. And I think that's awfully burdensome to some.
Yeah. Let's go to our phones now. Kevin Merida from The Washington Post, one of the editors of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Our first caller is Stephanie. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I heard you talk about the series of stories either on News and Notes or the Tavis Smiley Show. I can't remember which one, on the radio. And I got the book because I really was very, very interested as the mother of a black son. I have a son. I was very interested and intrigued by it. And so I've read this book, and I read it with the idea of having my son read it because he's 13. And I really enjoyed the book. And I think that in terms of Eric Motley, the people, you were talking about Eric Motley, and I think that one of the struggles that people had with him was that the individuals who raised him, his grandmother and the other people in the community who nurtured him, also looked at him in terms of, look, we literally saved your life because your mother didn't want you. She was going to just basically turn you over to the child welfare system. And then the person, one of the women who he had known, made the comment that the white community essentially came in and cherry-picked Eric out of our community because they came and they gave him all of these things, and then we sort of basically took him away. But I thought that it was I think it's a very interesting book, and I really enjoyed it, and so that's just all I had to say.
Stephanie, thanks for your comments.
Bye.
Thank you, Stephanie, for reading it.
And Vaughn is with us next. Hi, Vaughn.
No, this is Dawn.
Oh, Dawn, I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. Was the other lady finished?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I liked her comments, and I've heard you too, Mr. Meredith, on several different radio shows, and am thankful that Fred got you for his show, since we could call in. I just wanted to kind of continue from the last caller. I'm raising a son. My son is much younger, and he's in a predominantly white school because I put him in private school because I was concerned about the education he would receive in my neighborhood school, and I'm an educator. But the problem I have is similar to what she talked about. It's just the peril for me seems to be being successful, the definition of success in the quote-unquote black community, which is a huge community that's not monolithic at all, versus the definition of success in the broader culture, in the dominant culture of America. And I'm trying to raise my son so that he's cognizant of the ordeals that we have come through as a people in this country, but also raise him so that he'll be confident in the general society. And that's a hard place to be because now he's going to the second grade, is starting to see that there are some distinctions made. And it's interesting when he comes to me and says, well, why this or why that? And so I'm saying, my question to you is, what have you found from talking to other African-American men, successful, non-successful, everybody in the culture? What do you think is a good way to deal with raising our kids to teach them to not be afraid in this society, but to have self-esteem in this society and to still feel comfortable? My mother always says, if you're black in America, you are bilingual because you have to be able to speak to the larger culture and then turn around and come back in the neighborhood mm-hmm. and talk there too. So how do you teach that?
Okay, Kevin.
I think that's a great question, is one that many mothers are asking, and I thank you for it. I have three sons myself, and you know, so I understand a little bit what you're talking about raising them. I think that Robert Pierre wrote a little bit about this subject in his piece about a young guy, Marcus Yarborough, whose parents were concerned, wanted to give him all of the opportunities. He, too, was in a private school in a suburb, a far suburb of Washington, D.C. They are both successful and professionals, and they're trying to give their son everything, and yet they were kind of stealing themselves for the day when the boy would become a black boy. He would recognize that himself, or society would impose that on him. And yet you're wondering how to give him all the advantages and yet, you know, hope that he has some self-awareness of who he is also as a black man. I think that one of the things about this generation that's growing up now is the opportunity. I know that there are some class distinctions, but I think that increasingly if the more opportunity, that's the great door opener. The more that they're exposed to different things and they see the world around them, not only with other races and ethnicities and religious groups, but travel and experience. And I think experience is the great leveler. I mean, it gives you confidence to make your way in the world. And the more experiences kids have, I think, the better. I think history is always important, and it's something that, you know, our elders are always reminding us that, you know, let the kids know what happened before they came around, and that these opportunities that exist now were really on the backs of others. And you let them know about the struggles and the marches and also the greatness that came before them. And there's such a rich history that the young black men have. And so they need to know about that history as well.
Thank
I hope
you.
That's helpful.
Yes, it is.
Okay, John. Thanks for your call. Raymond is next. Hi, Raymond.
Hey, Fred. I see in our own Columbus community there are a lot of people who are recent African immigrants, particularly from Somalia, and they often live in the same areas as people who have been here for generations. The African Americans who have been here for a long time. There's often even some tension between them. I was wondering if your guest had any knowledge on the differences between these communities and the similarities
Between African Americans and various African immigrant communities.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, there is thanks for the question. There's tension, I think, everywhere. There's certainly in Washington D.C. And we've documented some of that in stories in the Washington Post. You know, I think there is often a question of I think some Africans who come here have often, I've heard this comment, that feel like African Americans who were born here don't realize the opportunity to have. Many of the Africans come from places that have been rife with civil war, and where literally their lives have been. They've been macheted, legs have been cut off. They're dealing with a lot of struggles, brutal regimes. And I think that to escape that and find opportunity here, they often think that African Americans complain too much, don't take enough of the advantages of the opportunity, and don't appreciate the history of their struggle. So I think that you see some tension. It works both ways, and I think that's just a product of all immigrant culture. I think that a lot of immigrants who come over here and see this country for all its greatness, don't share the same experiences of those who have been here and have lived through so much turmoil and struggle to get where they are. And so I think that is evident.
What do you think, Kevin, when an African immigrant says, look, you know, African Americans, you men, you complain too much. You don't realize the opportunities. You don't take advantage of them. How do you feel about that? I mean, is that accurate at all?
Well, I think that's it's accurate in individual cases. I think on the other side of it, I think what I hear a lot of times, because many African immigrants, at least in Washington, there's a big population of cab drivers. Many of them are cab drivers, and they are I've heard stories and I've experienced it firsthand of African immigrants passing by other African Americans as they wait for a cab, trying to go someplace at night. And so they're in a sense displaying the same kinds of stereotypes that maybe a white cab driver would display, worried that, you know, I'm not going to pick them up because I'm going to get, I don't want to get driven to a dangerous neighborhood at night, or they're going to stiff me on a tip, or, you know, so they're embracing some of the same kinds of, you know, racist notions that, that whites do. So I've heard that said a lot, and so that's the other side of that.
Raymond, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
And Kevin Merida joins us from the Washington Post this morning. He's one of the editors of the series, the year-long series featuring in-depth portraits of black men, appeared in 2006 in the Washington Post, and is now collected in a book called Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Kevin, we're going to take a 90-second break here, then back with you as my guest and also our callers here at WOSU 820, your all-day NPR news station.
Reporting on a repressive regime can be a challenge. Just getting in is hard. And once you're there, finding someone willing to speak openly can be even harder. NPR's Gwen Tompkins found out in Sudan.
You just never quite know whether you have the story, whether you've got the truth. And then you start wondering, well, what is true?
I'm Neil Conan. Dispatches from Dictatorships at the Newseum next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation will be here later this afternoon. It begins at 2 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 57 degrees at 10:32. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. This is an encore presentation of the best of Open Line. No phone calls, please. WOSU invites you to the Ross Media Lab for a digital scrapbooking class. The class is Saturday, May 24th from 10 a.m. till 12:30 p.m. And it serves as an introduction to digital scrapbooking using Photoshop elements. For more information, including registration, visit our website, wosu.org/medialab. Don't forget that weekday mornings you can prepare for the day with Morning Edition, starting at 5 a.m., now on WOSU 89.7 FM.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Foundation, proud to present Power of Philanthropy, a powerful new giving tool available to everyone. More information is available on the web at columbusfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. I'm Fred Anderley. We're learning more about the lives of African-American men here in the United States. A year-long series in 2006 from the Washington Post. 15 articles, also a website with video and audio. The articles and additional material collected in a paperbound book called Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. And let me give you the website as well. It's washingtonpost.com/blackmen as one word. washingtonpost.com/blackmen as one word, and you will find all kinds of additional audio, video materials, etc. My guest is Kevin Merida. He's one of the editors of the Post series and one of the writers of the series as well. We're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation. Kevin, you know, we talked about Will Haygood's piece on Eric Motley, who was very successful in the Bush administration. And it struck me that among the portraits I read, there were two people who were in gifted, in talented programs when they were in school. Eric Motley singled out Roy Young as a gifted and talented person. But the other one was the portrait you wrote of Anthony A.J. James, who at age 37 is a hardened street criminal. In the seventh grade, he had been in a gifted and talented program, just like Eric Motley. What happened?
I think that he succumbed to his environment. And I think that happens a lot. It was interesting because I found out that Anthony James was in the gifted and talented program when I was talking to him at essentially at the probation and parole supervision agency for ex-offenders in the district. And he was coming out of a kind of a counseling session, and he happened upon another guy who was there who had also served 10 years in prison, and they were the guy looked familiar, and so they began to recognize that they had both gone to the same middle school, and they began to reminisce and talk about, do you remember Miss Jones, and do you remember this person? And it was almost kind of like one of these nostalgic kind of moments where you could see in his eye he was kind of thinking back to a time before he had become really a thug on the streets, and he had just said that, well, I was in the gifted and talented program.
Yeah.
After that, he'd been shot. You know, that was the other part of this moment, was once they left the reminiscing, they began to talk about their shared, you know, street life. And A.J. was a drug dealer, someone feared in his neighborhood. He had lifted up his shirt to show me really what was a carved up torso. I think he had been shot. 7 times, 10 times, I can't remember which. And the other guy who was he was talking to had said, yeah, he had been shot a number of times too. And so it was almost like that was part of par for the lifestyle. I think that Anthony James took some pride in being feared on the streets and known on the streets. As he said, it's almost like being a celebrity. It without, you know, the autographs, but he said it was, you know, somebody had once told him it's a privilege just to hang out with you. And so I think he relished that because there wasn't much else that he could take by way of success. One of the things I found that's interesting about him and to others like him, black men, and there are certainly a disproportionate number of them in prison, is that there is so much talent in prison that seems to be wasting away. There's so much intellect in prison. A lot of guys with nothing to do spend time in prison trying to learn what they never learned on the outside through books and through experience, shared experiences. And AJ found something that he liked, which was writing. And he wrote a number of books that would just be described as kind of raw, crude street literature. But it made him want to become a writer and to think that he could maybe sell his work, which is mostly autobiographical, and then maybe segue into Robert Parker mysteries or even something of a classic like The Godfather. And so these are kind of distant dreams for him. But it was interesting just kind of trying to get inside the life of someone who really most of us have no access to.
Yeah, because as you say, he's not successful. He's living at home. He has no money, right? Or very little. He's beaten 3 murder raps, and he's been in jail on and off, and he pushes drugs. But here's a guy who wants to be a novelist. How long ago was that you actually did the portrait of him?
I did it. It was the last piece that ran in the series December. It ran actually December 31st, 2006. Mm-hmm. So it would have been last fall when I was working on it. He has, he had to go back into a drug rehab program, so to speak, for supervised inmates, because he's still kind of what you would call a supervised release, and he was just kind of out and still kind of monitored by the law. And I think he might have run into some other difficulties, I'm told, but he's still living around in Washington, D.C. and still under supervision.
No progress with his writing career, huh?
Well, I think he wanted to send out his manuscript to some various people who publish urban fiction, but no takers so far.
Mm-hmm. Edward Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, writes the foreword to Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. And Kevin, he writes, living in the greatest country takes a bigger toll on us, black men, than anyone else. We're even more vulnerable than most of us lived in the South. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think that the things that can happen to you, I think there's a sense of the black men that you have this kind of duality of fear and fascination. You know, I think there's a great fear of black men, and there's always, no matter if you're Edward P. Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, if he goes into a Saks Fifth Avenue and decides he wants to buy a sport coat, and maybe he's just dressed casually, and Ed has a very you know, rough look. He doesn't look like he's wearing, you know, $4,000 suits.
Yeah.
That he may get ignored. Someone may not pay attention to him. He may be out trying to catch a cab and not be able to pick one up. He may get mistaken for the chauffeur or the driver, the parking attendant at a hotel he's staying as he's getting ready to pick up the Penn Faulkner Award. There are a number of things that happen to you or things that you think about. We wrote a piece that Tamri Jones wrote in the series about Elias Fishburne,
yeah,
who was a guy, a hairstylist, pretty successful hairstylist in the Washington area. He was on his way to the gym, and he had a car accident on the highway, and when the state trooper went over to investigate the accident, and I guess put his name through the system, the criminal check system, he found that there was a warrant for him, an Elias Fishburne, and he was a fugitive from Atlanta. And despite the protest of Elias, who had never been in trouble before, he was taken down to the local jail, and again, couldn't talk his way out of it, and by some strange happenstance, ended up spending 30 days in jail, being taken not only from that jail, but transported to Atlanta, which is where the charges stood. And it turns out in the end that it was just a question of mistaken identity. Now, maybe that happens to everybody. Maybe that could have happened to someone who was white as well. But this was something that I think that every black man who is reading it knows that that's the kind of thing that might just happen to you. And mm-hmm. in this case, the interesting thing about that story was that in Elias's case, he discovered something inside jail that he had not discovered outside, which is a connection he had to other black men. He had never been in prison. He wasn't like many of those who were in jail, legitimate criminals, but he through his hairstyling and braiding hair, he had set up a makeshift salon of sorts in the bathroom of this jail, and he said he had more meaningful conversations with black men inside than he had had outside, and that was very eye-opening.
The amazing thing about this nightmare that he went through is that if anybody had taken the trouble initially to compare his fingerprints with the fingerprints of the guy who used Elias Fishburne as an alias, he immediately would have been released. They obviously had the wrong guy, but nobody did it. They just passed him on through.
Not to mention their photos are not yeah. alike at all, and their height, their weight. There was nothing in the physical description that would have it would have immediately said we got the wrong guy. But there was a sense that I think, and this gets back to what Edward P. Jones was talking about, that here's this guy with his locks, and he comes in saying he's innocent, and the sense that the jailers are saying, yeah, right, you're innocent, just like everybody else in here. And you wonder sometimes if he had been a white young man, maybe more, you know, clean-cut and protested his innocence, if there had been, like, at least a second doubt and said, well, maybe we ought to check this out a little closer. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is at least the perception and the feeling that many black men have in this country, regardless of income or educational status.
My guest, Kevin Merida, is one of the editors and one of the writers of the Washington Post series, Being a Black Man, and the articles and more information is collected in the new paperbound book, Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Let's go right back to our phones at 614-292-8513. Here's Travis. Hi, Travis.
Yeah, I'm a graduate student at OSU, and I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who's a professor at a university in the New England area about something that I'm passionate about, is the responsibility of the present generation of high achievers or whatever you want to say, the people who are 22 to 35 or 40 years old. And what I see is that it sort of piggybacks on the polling data you did, that that African-American men feel that there are still barriers to their success in this country created by the legal system, the political system, and other systems. But there are also, we also feel like there is a responsibility for us to do more, and we're not doing as much as we can. So I'm in. Want to talk about the second part of the polling data, how it seems that we're all focused on, not all of us, but many of us are focused on getting the next promotion, buying the next Lexus, or buying the biggest house on the block, and we don't take the time to mentor kids who are pretty much just like we were before we went to college or got a master's degree or MBA or PhD. And I think that we have sort of lost that connection to, some of us have lost that connection to the community itself, sort of what the two women talked about earlier, how they want the duality of being an African-American man. You want to be able to not lose connection to your community, but also be successful in the broader community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in many ways, we're focused, this generation, unlike our parents' generation and unlike our grandparents' generation, are so focused on being successful in the broader society that we lose touch with our community. The only time we come into community is to get a haircut or go to church. So if you could talk about that, how did you see that with your people? I read some of your work on thewashingtonpost.com. I didn't know the book was out. I'm sure I'll purchase that in the near future. But if you could talk about during your interviews or the interviews with the other authors did with your subjects, if you could talk about, did these people have, in the successful ones, however you want to define success,
mm-hmm. Kevin,
did these people have a connection to the community in some way?
Right.
Well, I thank you, Travis, for that question and comment. I think that is a revolving conversation within black communities, particularly as we see, you know, the high dropout rate among African-American males in high school, the state of education, and the number there's certainly a connection to the high dropout rate and the number of black men going to prison and not finding opportunities. There's not as many skilled jobs. And we have become, as you pointed out, the black middle class has grown, so there have been a number of achievements on that front, more and more successful African-American men. And so you have found that disconnect. I think that we certainly need to go back and try to save, many of these black men who see nothing. There are whole neighborhoods in our communities and black communities in which you see nobody going to work wearing a suit. Some places, nobody going to work at all. A very few, and no one with a briefcase, no one with a tie. So there's not like a lot of models in some neighborhoods. And as you pointed out, because of the income disparity, you don't have, as it were, in many years in previous generations, where you had everybody living in kind of homogeneous communities. I mean, you had the doctors and the teachers and the lawyers living with the bus drivers and those who worked at the 7-Elevens. And now you have, the more success you get, the more those people have left some of those same communities. And so you don't have as much opportunity. I think that they're, on the good news front, I do think that there are some things happening, because I do think that there are some people who take the commitment seriously. And just in the time that I became a black, grew up in the black man, there was, the 100 concerned black men, 100 black men, a number of organizations that have formed, that have taken kind of a responsibility to be connected to those communities. But I think that in our series, what we saw in some of the individual portraits is a sense that we do need to come together more as black men, and that is a huge responsibility that those who have achieved bear. And, that's mm-hmm. That's what I'd probably say about that.
Yeah. Travis, thanks for your question.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. A note in your book, Kevin, that 65-year-old Leonard Hodges says in the introduction, Edward P. Jones quotes him. He says, "When we were in the South, that's all we had was each other. Community held you up. Black people have lost that. We're separate now. Now we're fragile," he says. Okay.
Well, I think that, Mr. Hodges is expressing the kind of concern that, people of his generation have, that there isn't the sense, and I referenced it earlier about, you know, when you had communities where, black businesses were anchored there, everybody was living amid each other. And this is not to, to glorify segregation, because I think sometimes we romanticize that period. I mean, people were really being oppressed and held back and, really in dangerous circumstances in some in many respects. But I do think that there is a longing for some simple values before the internet and before everybody was on their cell phones and their Blackberries and playing their video games. So many kids grow up in, the high tech generation, and so I think it fosters a certain disconnection. It at least it intensifies that sense of disconnection. And I think that there are not many institutions that provide that. Certainly the church does, but even the church is different. I mean, now you have these huge mega churches, and even and those are, more like institutions than community places. They have their own bookstores and their, you know, 19 different ministries, and they're big operations in black communities. So even that's changed.
Mm-hmm. Back to our callers now, and Duane, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I know when I was younger, I was really concerned about bringing black boys into this society, today's United States society, and I was happy that I didn't have any boys. And but what I wanted to say about that is that you got to talk about women if you're going to talk about black men, and I'm glad that that our women are being accepted in this society if they look okay to the white society, and it seems like they're doing okay. And I was wondering to know if your book commented on that.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Well, yes. That was we had a piece. Well, in a couple of different ways. Your caller is exactly right. We did have a piece that dealt with how black women see black men, and it dealt through the prism of a woman who was single, a lawyer, and really kind of out searching for her ideal mate. But it also was through the prism of it was looking at the other black men in her life, which included her father and grandfather and the model that they set. I think that it is true that black women, and it's something that they have noted, they seem to be outpacing black men in educational attainment. When you go to some black colleges, you see, you know, the disparity between black women and men, young black women and young black men in college is great. In some places, 7-1. And so you see that in the high, the dropout rate is much higher for black boys than it is for black girls. So there's something happening in the nurturing process and what has happened to them. And there have been a lot of studies about the causes of that. But there's something happening with black girls that's not happening with black boys. We see that extends all the way up to the number of also boys born out of wedlock and boys that are, you know, being raised by single mothers, which is an issue that we tried to also deal with, the number of fatherless households. And so it's a very complex subject, and I'm glad you raised.
Well, my specific question, I guess, is how black women are treated in corporation arenas. Seems like they're hiring black women, but they're not hiring black men. So could you comment on that?
Well, I think, again, some of it has to do with, you know, you can also always speculate on the social reasons. People have said that black men are more threatening than black women are. It's easier to maneuver in the corporate world for black women than black men. But the other part of it is, again, we have more black women proportionally who are achieving advanced degrees and are in college and are graduating from college than black men. And so that's a part of that dynamic, too.
Dwayne, thanks for your questions. And Chris is here next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There's so many things I would like to say, but I would like to really talk most about how class and poverty and race all play into this, because I think that what I am learning is that there really is a class structure in this country and that there are rules that come with class, and those that are not born into the different class structures don't know and understand those rules. And I think that that there are disadvantages to blacks especially because they don't understand those rules at all. And that, I think, is, and I guess I want to say, and Fred has had many guests on that have talked about how this growing disparity between the classes is getting worse, and I think that that is even going to disadvantage blacks even more because of that.
Well, maybe Appalachian whites too, for example.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Kevin, what do you think?
Well, yeah, there's a class gap. I mean, that affects the entire country. I mean, and not just African Americans. I mean, I think that those who are on the other, the lower end of that ladder are finding more and more struggles. I mean, there are not as many, low-wage jobs, and we don't have the kind of vocational education we had when I was growing up. And so people are really struggling. You have more immigration in, so people competing for jobs, those low-wage jobs. And so you have a lot of complicated dynamics. I don't know that just affects the blacks, but I think it really is a kind of warning for the nation that unless we really do some improvement of schools and really try to get a better educated population and correct some of those disparities, we're really looking at a situation where we're not going to have people to do what we need to do to be able to run our country, to be the labor pool of our country.
Chris, thanks. Got to move on quickly here. Time for one quick question or comment from Melanie. Hi, Melanie.
Hello. I have not read your guest's piece, but I was wondering if you had included any profiles on the experiences of gay African-American men. And I'll take my comments off the air.
The experiences of gay African-American men. Okay.
Well, we because this was a multimedia project, it operated on a number of levels. And on our website, we did do a piece. This was after some gay men who were reading the series and enjoying it and talking about it, but felt that they weren't represented. We went and to the home of a gay man who was having a dinner party and invited a number of gay men, and we videotaped that and did kind of a mini documentary piece that actually won some awards. And it really kind of allowed us to kind of see gay men inside their home and to talk about various things that were on their mind. So I think that that was something, and still on our website that you could see, the WashingtonPost.com, www.WashingtonPost.com/blackmen will take you right to the archived homepage, and you'll be able to call up that video.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, we just have about a minute left here, and what's your takeaway from this series, having been one of the editors and one of the writers on the series, in terms of, I don't know, the future for African-American men, optimism, pessimism, et cetera?
Well, I think that there is what I think it shows is that we all need to be seen and heard. And I think it really it was able to, we were able to portray black men in kind of in their full portraits. And so I'm very optimistic of the future, because that's kind of me in general. I think that there are a lot of things that we have to struggle with in the country. But I think the reaction to the series by people around the country showed that it was the kind of work in a collaborative way, particularly with both print and what we are able to do online, that really drew people to this subject. And I think it was a good model for other projects like it.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Merida, one of the editors of the book by the staff of the Washington Post, the series and the website and now the book, Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Kevin, thanks for being with us this hour.
Hey, thank you for such a wonderful show, Fred.
Thank you. WOSU 820 AM Columbus, on the web at WOSU.org.